content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. Hello, this is Fred Woodward from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from The Week magazine, the best of the U.S. and international media. The Triangle Radio Reading Service thanks Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's reading of The Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. We're reading this week from the February 10th, 2017 issue of The Week magazine, the main stories and how they were covered. Travel ban prompts chaos, protests. What happened? President Donald Trump's temporary travel ban on visitors and immigrants from seven Muslim-majority countries triggered a firestorm this week, with mass protests at several major airports, widespread confusion among border control officials, and a growing spate of lawsuits challenging the order's legality. Signed late in the day last Friday, the travel ban blocks immigrants from Iran, Iraq, Libya, Somalia, Sudan, Syria, and Yemen for 90 days and suspends the U.S. refugee program for 120 days. With travelers given no prior warning about the new policy and many immigration officials unsure about how to execute it, more than 700 visa holders were prevented from boarding U.S.-bound flights. Hundreds more landed at American airports, only to be placed on returned flights or handcuffed, detained, and questioned for hours. Those caught up included entire refugee families from Syria, Iraqi interpreters who helped the U.S. during the Iraq War, and an Iraqi general currently leading the fight against ISIS. Permanent U.S. residents, known as green card holders, were initially among those banned, but are now being issued waivers. The ban, which immediately applies to more than 90,000 people in the affected countries who've been issued U.S. visas, as well as thousands of refugees waiting for admission, sparked spontaneous mass protest at major airports in cities including New York, Washington, Dallas, and Los Angeles. Lawyers and Democratic lawmakers also gathered at airports to help the detained travelers. In one of several lawsuits challenging the ban, a federal judge in New York issued a temporary injunction blocking the deportation of those detained. Acting Attorney General Sally Yates, a holdover from the Obama administration, instructed Justice Department lawyers not to defend the ban. She was immediately sacked by President Trump, who said she had betrayed his administration. Republican leaders backed the executive order, although several lawmakers expressed misgivings. GOP Senators John McCain and Lindsey Graham argued it would alienate Muslims here and abroad and boost recruitment for extremist groups, calling it a self-inflicted wound in the fight against terrorism. President Trump compared his policy to one enacted in 2011 when the visa process for Iraqis was slowed for evaluation, and noted that the seven nations were designated countries of concern by the Obama administration. "This is not a Muslim ban," he said. "This is about terror and keeping our country safe." What the editorial said: "The U.S. has long been the strongest voice for freedom and conscience and human dignity," said the Financial Times. "With this cruel and heartless move, President Trump has departed violently from that tradition. His ban provides nothing but an illusion of security. From 9/11 to this day, no immigrant or child of immigrants from Syria, Iraq, or any of the seven nations Trump designated has committed an act of terrorism in the U.S. Yet nations whose citizens have been involved in terrorism, Saudi Arabia, Pakistan, Egypt, and others, are exempt. Why? Refugees from Syria and other Middle Eastern nations are already the most vetted group of travelers to the U.S., said BloombergView.com. The process takes at least 18 months and involves background checks by several government agencies. Actually, Trump's temporary ban is mostly right on the substance, said NationalReview.com. With Islamic terrorists posing as refugees to obtain admission into Europe, it makes sense for the U.S. to evaluate and strengthen our own vetting process. But the implementation of the ban was a travesty. Its architects, White House Chief Strategist Steve Bannon and Senior Advisor Stephen Miller, overrode cautions from non and senior advisor, from lawyers about details of the order. Federal agencies and border control agents weren't given sufficient guidance, leading to ugly detentions, outrage, and spectacular protests. What the columnist said. Progressives will look for any excuse to call President Trump a bigot, said Adriana Cohen in the Boston Herald. This is not a Muslim ban. The vast majority of the world's 1.6 billion Muslims aren't affected. Trump isn't anti-Muslim. He's anti-radical Islam. The president is simply carrying out the promises that helped him win the election, said Chris Saliza in WashingtonPost.com. A Reuters Ipsos poll this week showed 49% of Americans supported the ban and 41% opposed it. And you can be sure that Trump supported in particular are overjoyed that he's doing what he said he would. Nonetheless, the ban is bad public policy and probably unconstitutional, said William Galston in the Wall Street Journal. The Constitution and the Immigration and Nationality Act of 1965 forbid discrimination on the basis of religion or national origin. Trump advisor Rudy Giuliani openly boasted that Trump had tasked him with finding a legal workaround for a Muslim ban. The fact that the order targets Muslims is further revealed by the administration's admission that it plans to give priority to admitting refugees who are Christian and Yazidi. Trump supporters should be worried about the stunningly inept way this executive order was implemented, said Noah Rothman in CommentaryMagazine.org. Our new businessman president was supposed to be more competent than career politicians. Yet this travel ban was rushed into effect without proper coordination and evaluation by government agencies, resulting in utter chaos, heartbreaking individual stories about refugees and visa holders, and a big dent in Trump's credibility. If doubts about Trump's competence grow, his already embattled presidency will be in trouble. And the controversy of the week, Mexico. Will Trump start a trade war? During the raucous rallies that helped propel Donald Trump to the White House, the nation of Mexico was one of his favorite rhetorical punching bags, said Leon Krauts in WashingtonPost.com. But the insults and abuse our bully-in-chief gleefully rained down on our southern neighbor last week were worse than anything in the campaign. First, President Trump signed executive orders affirming his intention to renegotiate the North American Free Trade Agreement and build his notorious border wall. Then, just prior to a scheduled meeting with Mexican President Enrique Peña Nieto, Trump insisted that he would make Mexico pay for the wall's construction, with White House spokesman Sean Spicer saying that could be accomplished by slapping a 20% border tax on items imported from Mexico. An affronted Peña Nieto canceled the meeting amid a diplomatic rift of magnitude not seen in decades. If we start a trade war with Mexico, said Greg Grandin in TheNation.com, Americans will suffer too. Mexico is our third biggest trading partner, and our consumers will pick up the cost of any tariff imposed on its products. Trump's new slogan should be, "Make avocados expensive again." Spicer later clarified his threat to impose a 20% import tax, said Eric Levitz in NYMag.com, saying he was referring to a longstanding Republican proposal for a border adjustment tax on all imports. Similar to the value-added tax used in most European countries, a BAT does raise the price of imports, but would also promote a stronger dollar. Since a stronger dollar buys more foreign goods, neither U.S. consumers nor Mexican suppliers would notice a big difference. Even some Democrats are pro-BAT, said Dylan Matthews in Vox.com. Because it would generate $1.2 trillion in revenue over a decade and make it harder for corporations to dodge U.S. taxes by offshoring their profits. The mechanics of the tax are complex, and so would be the politics of getting it through Congress. But a BAT wouldn't cause a trade war, and no, it wouldn't raise the price of your avocados. Scuttling NAFTA sure would, said Jude Weber in the Financial Times. If Mexico won't bend to Trump's demands and he withdraws from the U.S. from the treaty, as he has threatened, the effect on both nations' economies would be devastating. Trade between the U.S. and Mexico amounts to $580 billion a year, with about 5 million Americans' jobs depending on this exchange. Countless U.S. firms, particularly in the auto industry, depend on Mexican labor and products as links in their supply chains, and the savings produced by those chains have made American products competitive with those made in Asia and Europe. Pulling out of NAFTA would instantly stall production in factories in the U.S. and Canada, said the New York Times in an editorial. It would also push up the prices Americans pay for cars, fresh vegetables, fruits, and other products. Trump may not care, said Mona Sharin in NationalReview.com. He seems to harbor a deep and irrational need to insult and humiliate Mexico. To indulge that need and to fulfill his nativist pledge to his supporters, the president may well decide to enact reckless trade policies, regardless of the repercussions. Trump and his supporters should be careful what they wish for, said Elvia Diaz in azcentral.com. If the president does initiate a trade war or pull out of NAFTA, the Mexican economy will crater. The economic desperation that follows will produce a huge influx of poor, displaced Mexican workers, and believe me, there won't be a wall tall enough to keep them out. It was a good week for rebirth. After a South African man awoke after spending 21 hours in a locked morgue refrigerator, with his cries for help so frightening workers, they called the police to protect them from an irate ghost. The man had been sent to the morgue after an asthma attack seemed to leave him without a heartbeat. It was a good week for proving your point after Greg Phillips, a voter fraud activist who claims to have proof that 3 million people voted illegally in the 2016 election, was found to be registered in three states, Alabama, Texas, and Mississippi. Why would I know or care, Phillips said. It was a good week for trading your brother for a dog. After Cambridge University researchers found that children get more satisfaction from their relationships with family pets than they do from those with their own siblings. Dogs don't taunt you, and they don't steal your stuff. But it was a bad week for optimism. After the scientist behind the doomsday clock, a symbolic measure of the impending likelihood of the end of civilization, set it at 11:57:30. Closer to midnight than it's been since 1953. Scientists cited President Trump's statements on nuclear proliferation and climate change. It was a bad week for being too popular after Starbucks claimed a recent dip in sales, which led to a drop in stock prices, was caused by congestion at its stores. Lines are so long, the company said, that some customers are leaving without buying anything. It was a bad week for national security after the U.S.'s bacon reserves plunged to their lowest level since 1957 because of soaring demand. Pork belly prices jumped 20% over 3 weeks. While we're here, a short, boring, but important article. Trump picks new GSA head. President Donald Trump has replaced the acting head of the federal agency tasked with deciding whether he is in violation of his lease for the Trump International Hotel in Washington, D.C., and installed his own appointee. Norman Dong had become acting administrator of the General Services Administration at the time of Trump's inauguration, but 8 hours later, Trump replaced Dong with Denver-based GSA official Tim Horn, who coordinated the agency's transition with the Trump team. The GSA manages the federally owned old post office building where the Trump International Hotel is housed, and Democrats have asked the agency to terminate the hotel's lease, citing a provision that states no elected official shall benefit from the contract. Moving on to the briefing page, this week it is titled, Brexit Becomes Real. 7 months after a divisive referendum, the UK will soon launch the process for leaving the European Union. How has Brexit affected the country? Not as badly as many predicted. Before the historic plebiscite on June 23rd, the Remain camp warned that Brexit would cause economic chaos, a deep recession, plummeting stock prices, and skyrocketing unemployment. But most of those grim predictions, labeled Project Fear by those backing Leave, have yet to materialize. The United Kingdom's GDP grew 2% over the year, the fastest of any G7 nation. The London stock market, as measured by the FTSE 100, ended 2016 at a record high, and unemployment remained steady. The only economic bombshell was the pound dropping by 18% against the dollar, from $1.48 to $1.20, before recovering slightly in January. They told us we were doomed, said Jacob Rees-Mogg, a Conservative member of Parliament who backed Leave. They have been proved wrong. Yet many economists believe Brexit's true impact will become clear only once the negotiating process has begun. When will that happen? Tory Prime Minister Theresa May has pledged to trigger Article 50, the clause for exiting the 28-member bloc, by the end of March. That will begin a 2-year countdown to Britain's formal breakaway, during which London and Brussels will attempt to hammer out the terms of their divorce. May had planned to activate Article 50 without going through Parliament, but Britain's Supreme Court ruled last month that she would require approval from both chambers, a ruling that could delay the process. The justices also determined that the Prime Minister wasn't legally obliged to consult the devolved or national governments in Scotland, Northern Ireland, and Wales. That decision renewed speculation that Scotland, where the public-backed Remain, might try to break away from the UK, so it can stay in the EU. What terms does May want? Some Britons hoped she would try to keep Britain in the EU's single market, a soft Brexit. But that would undoubtedly have meant adhering to the bloc's rules on freedom of movement, which allow unlimited immigration and travel among member states, one of the EU features that motivated many Britons to vote to leave. So May has called for a hard Brexit, a complete withdrawal from the single market, but with a free trade deal offering the greatest possible access to it. She said the UK would no longer be subject to freedom of movement rules or laws made in European Court of Justice, vowed to guarantee the rights of Britons currently living in Europe and of Europeans in the UK, and pledged to strike new deals with trading partners around the world, including the U.S. May also said she would change the basis of Britain's economic model if Brussels didn't play ball. A thinly veiled threat to dramatically lower corporate taxes in order to entice big EU-based banks and other companies to the UK. If the EU tried to punish Britain for leaving, she said, it would be an act of calamitous self-harm. What about the EU? Britain is Europe's second largest economy behind Germany, so both sides want to work out a deal. But a pain-free Brexit could encourage other EU members to leave the bloc. So German Chancellor Angela Merkel has warned that Britain cannot cherry-pick the best features of its EU membership and dispense with the rest. Right-wing Eurosceptic parties are gaining popularity in Germany, France, and the Netherlands, all of which are holding elections this year. These and other EU members could well hold their own leave referenda. If another major country does follow Britain out of Brussels, the EU would almost certainly fall apart, likely unleashing economic and geopolitical chaos. How will it all play out? This is the first time a nation has left the EU, so it's uncharted territory. Negotiators will be unpacking 43 years' worth of treaties and agreements, covering thousands of different issues. Will a hard border be required between Northern Ireland, which is part of the UK, and the Republic of Ireland, an EU member? Will Britain pay the £50 billion exit bill the EU is planning on imposing? Everything is on the table. The final deal will need to be ratified by Britain's Parliament and by all 27 of the EU's remaining members. The negotiations can be extended beyond 2 years, but only if every EU country agrees. If no deal is approved within the allotted time, all EU laws and treaties will automatically cease to apply to the UK. Any chance of a do-over? Not really. The Conservative majority in the House of Commons will almost certainly overcome any efforts to block either the triggering of Article 50 or the final agreement. The House of Lords is largely opposed to Brexit, but the mostly wealthy members of the unelected upper chamber know that overturning the will of the people would lead to outrage and reforms to curtail the Lords' power. With both Conservatives and Labour pledging to press ahead, it appears that the die has been cast. "There's no going back," said David Davis, Britain's Brexit minister. "The point of no return was June 23rd. Into the best columns now. We'll read one from the U.S., titled, "Paul Ryan Does Have Principles." "Paul Ryan is not spineless," said Jonathan Chait. The Republican House Speaker is being widely mocked because he has backed President Trump to the hilt since the election, despite having repeatedly distanced himself from the GOP nominee's more offensive antics over the past year. After Ryan expressed support for Trump's travel ban, an idea dismissed as not conservatism a few months ago, critics even edited the Wikipedia invertebrate page to include a photo of the House Speaker. But in allying himself with the new Republican president, Ryan is being entirely consistent toward his most important principle: liberating the affluent from the burdens of progressive taxation. Ryan has often cited books by Ayn Rand, George Gilder, and other libertarians as his primary intellectual influence, books that portray democracy as flawed because it allows the unworthy masses to gang up on the rich and steal their money by taxing it. Since he needs Trump to push through a massive tax cut, Ryan will no longer criticize the irascible president in any substantial way. Now, you may or may not share Ryan's single-minded obsession with cutting top marginal tax rates, but it is a belief system. And two international columns. The first comes from Israel. U.S. embassy relocation looms. President Trump is playing a dangerous game in the Middle East, said Alex Fishman. For nearly 70 years, the U.S. has held off recognizing Jerusalem as Israel's capital, because the Palestinians also claim it as their capital, and any two-state solution will have to involve shared or international custody. But during the presidential campaign, Trump repeatedly promised to move the U.S.'s embassy in Israel from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem if elected, effectively recognizing Jerusalem as Israel's alone. His allies now say he intends to honor that pledge no matter what the consequences. Hamas and fundamentalist Muslims among Israel's Arabs are looking for any chance to inflame the street, and they would portray the embassy move as the return of the Crusaders. Jordan, which is in charge of the disputed Temple Mount area holy to both Jews and Muslims, would have no choice but to protest. And given that 10% of Jordan's people support radical Islamist movements, its very regime could be threatened. The unrest could stimulate the street in Egypt as well. There is no peaceful outcome here. Yet the Israeli government, rather than discouraging Trump, is doing everything in its power to make the embassy affair ignite a big fire. With Trump's help, we are shooting ourselves in the foot. This from New Zealand. Are we for sale to the ultra-rich? New Zealand has given its most precious gift to the billionaire Peter Thiel, said the Dominion Post in an editorial. The PayPal co-founder and Trump supporter apparently became a citizen here in 2011, although most of us just found that out last week. How did he qualify? Our green and pleasant land attracts throngs of would-be immigrants, and New Zealand tends to be particularly selective. We require potential New Zealanders not only to possess particular skills, but also to show a real commitment to this country by living here for 5 years. But the German-American Thiel, while he does own a mansion here, didn't do that. Instead, he was admitted under a special clause that lets the immigration minister bestow citizenship on any exceptional person. The argument was that, as a rich investor and charitable donor, he would bring special benefits to this land. So far, though, all he seems to have done with his status is buy up prime real estate on Lake Wanaka. That's particularly troubling since New Zealand's main resource is its beautiful land. This is a small country, and the billionaires of the world could buy and sell it many times over were we to allow them unfettered access to our real estate market. Our citizenship should not be simply for sale to the highest bidder. And the last word, the world's top feather detective. As the only criminal forensic ornithologist in the U.S., Pepper Trail helps build cases against bird smugglers and poachers, said writer Chris Sweeney. His mission? Protect rare birds by identifying them in death. Pepper Trail is the first to admit he has an unusual skill set. Give him a single feather or a small fragment of a claw or a cooked hunk of breast meat, and he'll tell you the species of bird from which it came. As the world's leading criminal forensic ornithologist, Trail is asked day in and day out to perform these exact tasks. Over the past 18 years, he has assisted with hundreds of investigations, testified in federal court 15 times, and handled more bird carcasses than anyone should. All birders have life lists, Trail said. I have a death list. Trail isn't joking. He opens a file on his computer and scrolls through a list of 750 species of dead birds he has identified through his career. The decor of his workspace at the National Fish and Wildlife Forensics Laboratory in Ashland, Oregon, blends bird nerd kitsch with macabre relics of closed cases. A waddling penguin pooper wind-up toy sits on a bookshelf still in its original packaging. Atop a filing cabinet is a confiscated necklace made from the claws and skull of a cassowary. Nearby is a long, sleek feather ripped from an Andean condor wing and attached to a pin that customs agents seized from a polka dancer coming into Chicago. There's actually a trade in condor feathers from Peru to Germany to decorate polka hats, Trail said. If a fish and wildlife agent ends up working a case that involves any sort of bird part, there's a good chance the evidence will land on Trail's desk for inspection. Because not all birds are protected equally, his IDs play an important role in the legal process that helps agents and prosecutors determine what laws are being broken and what charges can be brought against the perpetrators. It should come as no surprise that ornithological forensics is an exceedingly obscure career path. The field didn't even exist until the 1960s, yet the size and scope of Trail's caseload, more than 100 cases a year, involving well over 1,000 pieces of evidence, attest to the fact that this little-known arm of law enforcement plays a critical role in conservation. Sometimes Trail receives a blob of black sludge from an oil pit containing a decomposing bird and has to extract the feathers, restore them, and ID the species. Other times he gets the smashed remains of an animal demolished by a wind turbine. He has investigated high-end artifacts smuggled into the country, an indigenous Amazonian crown made from the curassow body feathers, toucan throat feathers, and scarlet macaw tail feathers, for example, and cheap dream catchers peddled at tourist traps across the Southwest. The findings go both ways. The evidence in question might be from perfectly legal turkey feathers or the feathers of a protected subadult golden eagle. In 2013, Trail received a shipment of 43 hummingbirds. The carcasses, which were each about the size of an index finger, had been dried out and stuffed into red paper tubes that were decorated with matching satin tassels. Accompanying each was a Spanish-language prayer meant to invoke the mystical powers of La Chuparosa, a colloquial Mexican name for the hummingbird, in order to help a man find his true love. That the animals were intact, no birdshot wounds, no decapitations, and with minimal damage to the colorful plumage, led Trail to suspect that they had been gently squeezed to death by one in a human hand. Trail didn't know what to make of them. When they first appeared, it was like, "Holy crap, what in the world is this?" he said. A special agent had obtained the birds during an undercover buy from a man who was smuggling them in from Mexico. Following protocol, Trail unwrapped the birds from their ceremonial garb, identified the different species, and filed the necessary paperwork. A year later, another shipment arrived, and then another. The victims spanned at least 10 species, including violet-crowned, magnificent, and blue-throated hummingbirds, dazzling border species that attract birders to southern Arizona each year. As familiar as trail is with death, these hummingbirds packed an emotional punch. Their very tininess makes them delightful and charming. Their extraordinary flying ability makes them impressive and awe-inspiring, he says. Our power compared to their power is so great that it seems particularly perverse and cruel to kill them. At age 63, Trail has identified enough dead birds for a lifetime, and he is looking at the prospect of retirement with greater fondness. More uplifting pursuits surely await the gentle soul who in his downtime pens award-winning poetry and dresses up as Charles Darwin to deliver scientific lectures. But at the moment, Trail's retirement would spell disaster for the only wildlife forensics lab in the world. Pepper is one of a kind, said Ken Goddard, director of the lab. If something happens to Pepper, we are SOL. Pepper Trail didn't set out to make a name for himself in the dark world of avian-associated crimes. He was born in Virginia. His great-grandfather was Paris Pepper Trail, and his great-uncle was Peach Trail, but grew up in the Finger Lakes region of New York. A boyhood spent exploring the outdoors and admiring wildlife led to a degree in biology and a Ph.D. in ornithology from nearby Cornell University. As a young ornithologist, Trail plodded through South American rainforest in pursuit of the Guinean cock of the rock. Then he strung together a few postdocs, which eventually landed him and his family in American Samoa. Island life was a formative experience, but with two young sons, priorities shifted, and Trail and his pediatrician wife moved to Ashland, a crunchy college town in southern Oregon, world famous for its Shakespeare Festival. The old Samoa to Ashland routine, Trail jokes of the transition. The job market has never been friendly to ornithologists, so Trail split time during those first years back in the States, picking up contract work, raising his sons, and writing a sci-fi eco-thriller for young adults. Out of the blue one day in 1998, he received a call from the National Fish and Wildlife Forensics Laboratory, which happened to be a short drive from his home. The lab's first and only ornithologist had left suddenly and cases were piling up. They needed a stopgap and wanted to know if Trail was available for a few months. What started out as a temporary gig has blossomed into a nearly two-decade-long career. The forensics lab where Trail spends his days is an impressive facility equipped to analyze whatever evidence Fish and Wildlife special agents can uncover, whether it is illegal timber or a purported aphrodisiac made from bear gallbladders. There is a ballistics expert on staff, as well as genetics and pathology departments, an entire biosafety level 3 lab, and DNA sequencing technology that seems fit for an episode of CSI. Trail's tactics, however, are decidedly more analog. He's a morphologist who makes identifications by carefully studying and comparing anatomical characteristics of different bird parts. In most cases, this approach is not only faster and cheaper than booting up the sequences and calling the genetics team, but it's also equally effective. It has to be. Much like forensic evidence in a murder trial, the science behind Trail's work needs to withstand the scrutiny of aggressive defense attorneys, diligent judges, and impartial juries. While from the outside the job can look like it's all gloom and doom, the analytical rigor it demands nourishes and inspires Trail's inner scientist. Patterns in his caseload have proven to be good fodder for research pursuits. For instance, after identifying thousands of birds that had died in oil pits, pools of runoff, and waste that are found at oil production sites, Trail collected the data, crunched the numbers, and published the most comprehensive scientific review of the issue, estimating that upward of 1 million birds perish in the pits each year. the vast majority of which are protected species. Moreover, Trail had devised and documented a method for determining an eagle species based solely on the curvature of detached talon fragments. He is a scientist in the fullest sense of the word, said Ed Espinoza, deputy director of the forensics lab. In the chain of command of wildlife law enforcement, Trail occupies a unique space. He doesn't chase down bad guys or trek around collecting clues. Instead, he enters the fray in the middle of an investigation, identifies the evidence, and then moves on to the next case. Oftentimes, he is intentionally kept in the dark with regard to the investigation's details so that the circumstances of the alleged crime can't influence his scientific judgment. Rarely does he have the bandwidth to follow the case long enough to learn whether or to what extent the perpetrators are prosecuted. Every once in a while, though, a case will be so perplexing or so unsettling that Trail can't help but lose himself in it. Take the Chuparosas, for example. The most recent shipment of the hummingbird charms, which remains under active investigation, arrived at his office in February 2015. Because hummingbirds are protected by the Migratory Bird Treaty Act, Trail has been working closely with Special Agent James Markley in hopes of digging up everything they can on the trade to understand its size and impact. It's pretty much unknown among U.S. ornithologists that this trade even exists, Trail said. Based on what they've seen so far, Trail and Markley have concluded that the birds are killed and packaged in Mexico, then smuggled into the United States, where they are sold at botanicas, small shops that specialize in things like herbal remedies and religious trinkets. It's not hard to find them, said Markley, whose investigations have focused on the Dallas area. The charms are similar to a rabbit's foot in American culture. Carrying it and good fortune will follow, though chuparosas appear to be specifically for amorous pursuits. Markley has been told that they are sold to help soothe the heartbreak of grieving widowers and help adulterous Romeos avoid chance encounters between their wives and mistresses. Mostly, though, they're meant to help lonely-hearted singles find their soulmates. Trail worries that the black market for these love charms may be vast. In Mexico, where the spiritual legacy of hummingbirds stretches back to the Aztecs, the trade appears robust. Among the more troubling clues he has come across is a small sticker on the packaging of some of the charms that says, Hecho en Mexico, or Made in Mexico, a sign that there is some sort of commercial-scale operation. As for how many hummingbirds are killed each year, Trail can't yet hazard a guess, because the trade is so new to investigators and information is hard to come by. In the only known study of the trade, researchers counted 655 charms during visits to Mexico City's Sonora market. Many of the vendors interviewed for the study said the birds are killed by slingshot and collected from the states near the center of the country, including Querétaro, Hidalgo, and Puebla. Trail knows all too well that fighting any type of wildlife trade comes with logistical, financial, and cultural challenges. He has begun collaborating with Mexican ornithologists who know of chuparosas but have never considered them a conservation issue. Meanwhile, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service has only 250 or so special agents, which makes it difficult to devote resources to the problem. Trail doesn't know for sure when he is going to walk away from the forensics lab, but he's hoping that the service soon hires his replacement, so he has at least a year or two to share the wisdom he has gleaned from the many cases that have passed across his desk. For a man who has devoted his career to protecting birds by identifying them in death, a sense of finality can seem elusive. There are a couple of trade items that I've come across in my career that I feel are a little bit unresolved or that I would like to have some closure on, Trail says. One is the chuparosas. This was excerpted from an article that originally appeared in Audubon magazine. We'll read one of the obituaries this week. The sitcom star who defined the modern career woman. Mary Tyler Moore, 1936 to 2017. For generations of women, Mary Tyler Moore was a symbol of liberation. On the Mary Tyler Moore Show, which ran from 1970 to 1977, the comic actress played Mary Richards, a spunky single TV news producer who embodied a new American archetype, the independent career woman. But her perky go-getter TV image, which included one of the broadest, toothiest smiles in showbiz, disguised a succession of personal tragedies. Moore endured illness, alcoholism, and devastating loss, yet she never lost her comic edge. Three things have helped me successfully go through the ordeals of life, she once quipped. An understanding husband, a good analyst, and millions of dollars. Born in Brooklyn, Moore moved with her family to Los Angeles when she was 8 years old, said the New York Times. Her father, a clerk, and her mother, a homemaker, were both alcoholics, and Moore chose to live with her aunt in L.A., only seeing her parents on special occasions. She landed her first showbiz job at age 17, starring in appliance commercials as Happy Hot Point, a caped dancing elf in a body stocking. The following year, she married her first husband, cranberry product salesman Dick Meeker, with whom she'd have her only child, Richie. Moore scored her first regular acting role in 1959 as Sam, the sultry-voiced telephone operator in Richard Diamond, Private Detective, said the Los Angeles Times. She was never seen in the show, save for provocative close-ups of her legs and mouth. Frustrated, she requested more screen time and was axed after 13 episodes. Small TV parts followed, and then Moore auditioned for the role of Danny Thomas' daughter on his sitcom, Make Room for Daddy. She missed out by a nose, her own, which the large-nosed Thomas thought too pert to belong to his on-screen child. But while casting the Dick Van Dyke Show in 1961, executive producer Thomas asked, "Who was the kid we liked so much last year? The one with the three names and the funny nose?" As Van Dyke's slightly scatterbrained wife, said the Washington Post, Moore held her own among a cast of comedy vets. After Van Dyke wrapped the sitcom in 1966, Moore and her second husband, ad agency exec Grant Tinker, formed a production company, MTM Enterprises, and developed The Mary Tyler Moore Show. With sharp scripts and an expert ensemble that included Ed Asner, Valerie Harper, and Betty White, it was indelible from the catchy opening theme, "Who can turn the world on with her smile," to its sign-off, a meowing MTM kitten. When the show ended in 1978, MTM was thriving. It had already produced The Bob Newhart Show and would go on to make TV hits including Hill Street Blues and Remington Steel. Moore began to stretch her acting range and was nominated for an Oscar for her frosty matriarch in 1980's Ordinary People, Robert Redford's directorial debut. But as her career hit new highs, Moore's private life was racked with pain, said The Guardian. Her youngest sister died of a drug overdose in 1978. 2 years later, Moore's drug-addicted son shot himself and died in what appeared to be an accident. In 1981, she divorced Tinker. She was already struggling with alcoholism. Now her addiction became almost all-consuming. "I'd gone over an edge," she said. I didn't know what to grab for steadiness. 5 weeks at the Betty Ford Clinic in 1984 brought sobriety. a 33-year marriage to cardiologist Robert Levine, whom she wed in 1983, brought happiness. "It has been a wonderful life," Moore said in 1995. "There are very few things I would go back and do differently." From there, we're going to go right over to the Talking Points page, where we'll finish out the hour. Bannon, the power behind the throne. "Steve Bannon has quickly become one of the world's most powerful people," said Zach Beauchamp in Vox.com. Until last year, the former Goldman Sachs banker ran the extreme right-wing website Breitbart.com, home of the white nationalist alt-right. After stepping in to help run Donald Trump's faltering presidential campaign, Bannon was elevated to White House chief strategist and has already pulled off a power grab that's made him Trump's most influential advisor. Bannon played a major role in crafting the president's aggressively populist inaugural speech and was the driving force behind the controversial travel ban and other executive orders. He also led the administration's war on journalists, telling the media to keep its mouth shut. And in an unprecedented move for a political operative, Bannon was last week given a full seat on the National Security Council, the president's key advisory group on foreign policy. "Bannon is a deeply alarming character, a true radical," said Heather Digby Parton in Salon.com. Only last summer, he described Trump as a blunt instrument for achieving Bannon's own aims to blow up everything and destroy the existing social and political order. Why? In interviews, Bannon has described Christian civilization as under mortal threat from unassimilated immigrants and radical Islam, threats he believes a decadent secular West hasn't taken seriously. What is such a xenophobic ideologue doing on the National Security Council? Said David Rothkopf in the Washington Post. Bannon's 7-year stint in the Navy 35 years ago hardly qualifies him to advise the president on national security issues. Incredibly, Trump has given Bannon a more powerful NSC role than the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff and the Director of National Intelligence, who will henceforth only attend council meetings when their specific expertise is seen to be required. No doubt about it, Bannon is the central force shaping Donald Trump's presidency, said Adriana Carrasquillo in BuzzFeed.com. But can he retain the mercurial Trump's trust? Bannon once compared himself to Thomas Cromwell, noting that Henry VIII's influential advisor had helped usher in the English Reformation by giving force to Henry's declarations. Trump, however, doesn't like his aides to get too much credit or attention, and won't be happy people are starting to sarcastically call his chief strategist President Bannon. Don't forget, Cromwell was executed for treason by a fickle king. Pro-life march, a growing optimism. After 4 decades on the defensive, pro-life activists are finally feeling a sense of hope, said Emma Green in the Atlantic.com. Last week, several hundred thousand anti-abortion demonstrators amassed in Washington, D.C. for the March for Life, held annually since the Supreme Court's 1973 Roe v. Wade decision upheld abortion rights. This year's march was more celebratory than ever, thanks to the election of Donald Trump, who vows to defund Planned Parenthood and nominate pro-life conservatives to the court. The staunchly pro-life Vice President Mike Pence told cheering marchers that life is winning America. And evangelicals present described Trump as the most pro-life president in the history of the Republic. Trump is the religious right's Trojan horse, said Michelle Goldberg in the New York Times. Failing to nominate one of their own, Christian conservatives gambled on a profane, thrice-married Manhattan cyberite. Trump won 81% of white evangelicals, more than born-again George W. Bush ever did. Trump is making good on his promises to them, filling his administration with culture warriors like Health and Human Services nominee Tom Price, who co-sponsored House bills granting personhood status to zygotes at the moment of conception. Sometimes a deal with the devil pays off. Big league. If these marchers really cared about life, said Liz Plank in Vox.com, they would march against the Obamacare repeal, which will deprive millions of life-saving health care, or looming cuts to CHIP, a federal insurance program that serves 8 million low-income kids. Why don't pro-lifers ever show concern for children who are already living? That's an old fallacy, said Margot Cleveland in TheFederalist.com. Most pro-lifers are conservatives who do not believe that government is better at meeting people's needs than charity or the private sector. Liberals insist that unless we protest every worldly wrong, we have no right to oppose slaughtering unborn children. Liberals are now on the defensive on abortion, and for good reason, said Rebecca Hagelin in the Washington Times. A recent Gallup poll shows 53% of millennials believe abortion should be illegal in all or most cases. Having grown up in a world where 3D ultrasounds show the preborn yawning and stretching and sucking their little thumbs, young people don't view them as meaningless clumps of cells. Soon, our nation will be able to proclaim, "Life has won." And we'll finish up today with two quotes. I couldn't decide between the two, so the first is from Mary Tyler Moore. If I don't go to work a little scared, I don't have any interest in it. And finally, from Lily Tomlin, behind every failure, there is an opportunity someone wishes they missed. With that, we've run out of time for today's episode of the week. Be sure to listen again next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Fred Woodward. The Triangle Radio Reading Service thanks Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's Reading of the Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. The broadcast is available as a podcast right after the broadcast at our website, TriangleReadingService.org. Questions or comments? Give us a call, 919-832-5138.